One wouldn't think that was possible. But you are. Deitch hates me. Drusus wants to neutralize me. I've been boxed in out here. Damned no matter what I do.
I let her think for a few seconds more. Then I spoke in a gentle tone. What are you going to do, Tribune? Call home for more legions? That's what I'd do.
That would be a display of weakness, and you know it.
Losing badly and getting our entire legion wiped would be a worse disaster. She sat up slowly, her eyes narrowing again. She focused them on me.
This is why you really came here tonight, isn't it?
She asked in a deceptively quiet voice.
What? No, sir, I came to show you Winslade's drone. And to see you, too, of course. That's the God's honest truth.
She stared at me, sighed, and nodded her head. She'd bought my lies.
All right,
she said.
I will consider requesting reinforcements. Now, however, you must head back to the front. Another attack will be coming soon.
What kind of attack?
They'll breach the hull. They won't do anything too drastic. They don't want to wreck the factory any more than we do. But they will attack.
Right, I said. What are our orders, sir? She frowned at me.
To hold, of course. To kill so many they're forced to retreat. Graves will push them back. I have faith in him.
It was my turn to frown in concern. I set my glass down on her tiny bar and turned to go. Adjusting my kit in the mirror, I was surprised when she came up behind me. Looking in the mirror with me, she fluffed up my hair and cap, even though she had to stand on her tiptoes to reach.
You know, I said, I think this is about the first time we've parted ways without either of us raging at the other.
Galena smiled in amusement.
You're probably right.
I left then, and I walked straight past the vet I'd tangled with hours ago. He watched me go, shaking his head in disbelief. Normally, I'd have said something to goad him, but I didn't have the heart. A battle was coming, and I knew it was going to be a bad one. Due to pride, hope, or just plain cussedness, Galena wasn't going to call for the reinforcements we so desperately needed. I'd failed in my mission to persuade her, and I wasn't sure what to do next. Things were playing out just the way Leeson had said they would. Returning to the space factory and my unit, I was met with suspicion from everyone.
McGill! Leeson shouted. Imagine seeing you down here with us lowly grunts. Maybe we should all gather around and get your autograph. Here, you want to sign my helmet?
Come on, Leeson, I said. It was your idea.
Yeah, I said you should go off and talk to the brass, but you stretched that into spending the night AWOL. That's pure McGill.
Harris came up to me next, and he got into my face. He wasn't in a joking mood like Leeson was, not at all.
Well, he demanded. When are they coming? Will it be Victrix or Germanica?
What?
Our reinforcements, you damn fool,
he said, suddenly angry. He got that way when he was scared, but that was something he'd never admit.
Oh, yeah, about that, don't tell me, he said, walking away and shaking his head. You just spent 9 hours chasing tail, didn't you? Did you forget what you were supposed to be pushing for? Did you even mention it to her?
I did, I said. I truly did, but she wants us to give Varys one more shot. She's not convinced we need help, not yet.
Harris gave a bitter laugh. He crooked his finger to me, beckoning. Come here. Take a walk with me.
Wary, but trying to look unconcerned, I followed him. He led me into a long, empty passage. He paused there, in the attitude of someone listening closely.
You hear that?
He asked.
Hear what? Take your helmet off. Go on, do it. He took his off, so I followed suit. We both listened for a moment. Then I heard it. A squeaky, grinding noise.
You hear that?
Harris whispered.
Their sappers are drilling into the hull, all over the place. They have this facility all mapped out. They know where every duct is, every passage and chamber.
So they're drilling holes? So what? If they try to make one big enough to wriggle through, we'll know and shoot them the moment they try to invade.
Harris laughed bitterly. You're not getting it. They aren't drilling big assholes with augers. They're making small ones and filling them with shaped charges.
My face fell and I looked at the ceiling. The squeaking and grinding began again. It could have been my imagination, but it sounded like this hole was being drilled a bit to the left of the last one. The situation reminded me of when we got rats in the attic in springtime.
You hear them? Harris said. These Vulpites aren't stupid, see? They'll plant small charges. They'll blow them all at once, depressurizing all the chambers along the outer decks. Then they'll flood in, thousands of them all at once. There won't be any warning because the explosions will be coordinated.
Hmm, I said, thinking over his idea. That way, there won't be much damage to the equipment. They wouldn't have to open the whole place to space.
Right. Surgery, not butchery.
So saying, Harris put his helmet back on and leaned against a wall.
Here, he said in a hushed tone. Lean right here for a second.
I did so, warily. After a while, when the squeaking began again, I felt a vibration that must have been transmitted through the walls into my boots and pack.
You feel that?
Harris asked.
Yeah. That's the sensation of doom, boy. The devil is tapping on our shoulders. We're about to be up to our assholes in bugs.
I didn't say anything. It was pretty clear. Harris was right. Thinking hard, I tried to come up with a solution, but I drew a blank.
When do you think they'll hit us?
I asked.
The second they're all set up. Not too long now. Hours, not days.
Nodding, I agreed with him.
Damn it, Galena, I said aloud. Why do you have to be born so vain?
Harris laughed, but there wasn't any joy in the sound. Chapter 26. The Vulpites were clever. They drilled more than just holes for explosives. They'd sunken listening probes into the hull as well. When we were at our lowest ebb, the artificial moment we called dawn in our cycle of time, their listening devices detected the drop in activity. That's when they hit us. It was when all the explosions, alarms, and shouting began throughout the vast complex that we knew they'd been listening up there. They'd waited until they'd noticed a marked reduction to our movements and energy levels. In that moment, they struck. We weren't ready. A soldier can only stay alert and tense for so long. Once a man's done that for 20 or 30 long, long hours, the edge is gone. Adrenaline counters that natural state of fatigue, but it isn't perfect. Far from it. Staggering up, fumbling with weapons, releasing incoherent shouts, we tried to pull it together. Vulpites dropped through the roof, but not directly into the chamber we were holed up in. Oh no, they were too cunning for that. They came down in every surrounding passageway, cutting off our unit from everyone else. The truth was that we didn't have the numbers to cover this place, nor did we have the kind of warship that could be tasked with cleaning them off the roof of the complex. We were a ground force spread thin, and they outnumbered us. Thousands poured into the passages. A savage battle began. We hadn't been idle, of course. We'd set up traps for them everywhere. Automated turrets chattered like sprinklers. Grav grenades went off with blue-white flashes tearing the enemy apart. Just as great as our shock was, theirs had to be even worse. They died and died,
squirming bodies piled up, forming wriggling mounds of flesh in the passages. But another wave came minutes later, right on the heels of the first one. This wave crawled on the walls and the ceiling, avoiding the littered floor. They crawled closer to us, using the bodies of their fallen comrades as cover. We had well-positioned firing squads at every open hatch. We sprayed the attackers, killing them at a steady rate. But then, as they kept advancing, despite losses, one of them managed to lob a smoking sphere of vapor into our midst. It popped, and the black, acidic fog roiled up around our legs. It ate into our suits, making the polymers, anything that wasn't glass or metal, melt away. Soon, our suits had breaches, and our air leaked out. Worse, the acidic vapors began to leak in. "Squad, vent the chamber!" I ordered. "McGill!" Winslade called out in alarm, but he didn't finish. He began screaming instead. The black vapor had gotten into his suit. His flesh began to liquefy. My people jumped in the low G and slammed fists on the releases. The top hatch, the big one, blew open. There was so little pressure left that the door flew away into space, almost silently. The last of our air managed to suck out the vapor with it as it fled into nothingness. The black vapor was instantly rendered ineffective. It had spread out too thinly in space to burn us any longer. We had new problems, however. "Vobites!" Harris called out. "Up top!" They were crawling to the new unexpected breach we'd created and poking their weapons into it. They showered us with fire, and we returned the favor. Running my eyes over the numbers, breathing hard, I tried to take account of the situation. We'd lost Winslade and about half our troops. "Leeson!" I called out. There was no answer. His name was red on my HUD. "Harris! You still with me?" "Until hell freezes over." "Okay, let's do something." "Something crazy?" he asked me. "Yeah, I'm game. We're dead anyway. Lead on, McGill." I jumped up to the hatch we'd blown open. There were a few Vobites up there, but not too many. Most had already entered the complex. They were down in the passages now, digging deeper, trying to crush us. "Unit," I shouted. "Follow me, up and out." Sargon was still among the living, as were several of the heavy troopers. They followed me without an argument. Harris brought up the rear, firing with controlled bursts whenever he saw a Vobite poking up from cover. We were good, you have to understand. Earthmen of the past, they only had one life to spend learning all the ins and outs of combat. When they became true experts, should they live so long, they were usually too old to be at their peak. We had unfair advantages— the minds of old, experienced killers, and the bodies of youthful men and women. We had it all. Our shots were more accurate, more precise, and more decisive than the enemy could hope to be. Most of my recruits and heavy troopers had perished, but I recognized one face inside a helmet. "Cooper," I called out. "Is that you?" "Yes, sir, I'm still alive." "Good, I have a job for you. Scout ahead. Find me a path. Feed it back to me via your tapper." "The enemy will trace that, sir," he said. "That's right." He didn't groan. He didn't even respond. He just stared at me. "Are you up for this?" I asked him. "Where am I going, adjunct?" I pointed. "That big, fat umbilical over there. I want you to lead us to it without running into an enemy concentration. It should be easy to do. Most of the Vobites are inside the complex. They aren't expecting a counterattack. Not out here." Cooper eyed the umbilical. It looked like a giant air-conditioning duct, and it reached from the belly of the space complex all the way to the surface of Dark World. From our perspective, that was up, but it really didn't matter what you called it. He didn't ask any more questions. He just rushed off into the dark, weaving between the obstacles, dashing from one scrap of cover to the next. Sargon came up to me. "He's a good kid," he said. "You doing this just to kill him?" "What? No." Sargon looked me up and down. "He told me he took a shit on your desk back at Mustering Hall. Says it was the worst thing he ever did." I laughed. "Nah," I said. "I'm not pissed about that, not anymore." Sargon smiled. "I told him that. I told him the boss doesn't hold a grudge, not after several solid killings. Not sure if he believes me, though. He's a bright boy. After another dozen trips through the revival machine, he'll be fully educated."
Sargon laughed and stepped away from me. What was left of our unit moved as a scattered group. We maintained a distance of about 5 meters between us, just in case the ground lasers noticed us and tried to burn us down. As we covered ground rapidly, I noticed a vast number of small, dark holes in the hull at our feet. They weren't big enough for an armored man to pass, but they would fit a light trooper, or a Vulbite. We reached the umbilical after about 10 minutes of rapid progress. The shocker was that Cooper made it all the way out there, still very much alive. We'd only encountered and killed a score of the enemy on the way, mostly wounded types and communications relay troops working equipment. Rushing them by surprise, we took them out one by one. I knew we were living on borrowed time, of course. Either the enemy would send out a counterforce or they'd use their planet-bound beamers. One way or the other, they'd kill us eventually. But sometimes, in the heat of battle, a small force can flank and take significant action. I hoped this would be one of those times. We reached the umbilical, and we began to set charges. The whole thing was relatively flimsy. Torn loose from its moorings, it should rip loose and fall down into the atmosphere, burning up and collapsing of its own weight.
Unit 3,
a familiar voice buzzed in my helmet. It was Primus Graves.
McGill, are you the one who's out there on the roof?
Only Harris and I could hear Graves as he was using command chat, and the other officers were all dead. Harris looked at me and I looked at him. We were both breathing hard.
Just stay quiet, Harris said. You've got mute on, we both do. Just ignore him and set these charges. This whole thing will be over in 5 minutes.
I sucked in a deep breath and let it out slowly.
McGill, damn your worthless skin, answer me,
Graves bellowed. Looking at Harris, I knew what he wanted. If the umbilical was destroyed, the complex would be worthless. It would take months or even years to repair. We'd probably be recalled, or reinforcements might be dispatched. Either way, the meat grinder would stop grinding for now. But I was thinking of bigger things. We were in a war, after all. Earth needed this planet. Drusus had carefully laid out the case for that, and I, for one, had been convinced he was right.
This is our forward base, I said to Harris. Oh, now, hold on, McGill, Harris shouted. Don't tell me you've gone and turned into a law-abiding citizen all of a sudden. This is over. I don't want to crawl on top of this tin can for one more.
Primus Graves, I transmitted. McGill reporting, sir. We're at the base of the umbilical.
What the fuck are you doing out there, McGill? Do not repeat, do not blow that strategic asset. Do you copy that?
Yes, sir, I wouldn't even consider it. We're just ambushing Vulbites as they come up from the planet to reinforce. Harris was hanging his head and groaning. Sweat dribbled and spread over his helmet's faceplate.
All right, Graves said. Hold out as long as you can. Graves out.
When the contact closed, Harris didn't raise his head.
We were so close, man, he said. So close.
Don't worry, Harris, I told him. I've got a better idea. He lifted his head again.
Are you shitting me? Don't mess around. That's not cool, McGill. Not today.
I'll tell you all about it later, if it works out. With those words, I flipped open my faceplate. It was a bad move. I should have shot myself instead. Dying in hard vacuum is a nasty way to go. Your blood begins to boil. Your lungs and eyeballs freeze solid. I didn't have to experience the whole thing. A spray of snap rifle bullets crashed into my skull before the end. Harris did it, I was pretty sure. Maybe he knew I'd meant to commit suicide and he decided to help me out. Either that, or he was getting petty revenge on me for having talked to Graves. Chapter 27 I've died and been brought back to life any number of times, but I usually didn't try so hard to get off the table and get moving. What's the score? A male voice asked.
8.5. I'm calling it a good grow.
Get off me. I mumbled, struggling to open my eyes. The lights seemed brilliant, dazzling.
As was always the case, I felt the pain of using eyeballs that had never focused or dealt with vision before. It was kind of like being under studio lights with a serious hangover. Sitting up, I swayed on the edge of the table. Beginners would often take a first step right then, but I was no beginner. My balance was off. I could feel it. The inner ear, the nervous system, everything was settling in. Revival machines weren't exactly machines, and they didn't exactly revive a person either. Using a process akin to flesh printing, what they really did was grow a new body inside an artificial organic sac. Functionally, the alien contraption was the newly copied person's mother, in a disturbing way. The whole process was messy and stomach-twisting. It didn't bear thinking about. When I knew I could stand up straight, I climbed off the gurney and pulled on clothes. "Don't you want a shower?" the bio leader asked. "We highly recommend a shower." "I wish I had the time," I said, "and I thank you for the offer, but I've got to get going." The bio was a tall fellow with a narrow, intelligent-looking face. "What's the hurry, adjunct?" he asked. "You're not going to win this battle single-handed." There was a hint of defeat in his tone. I forced my bleary, burning eyes to focus on him. "What's the story?" I asked. "What's happened since I went out?" The bio slid his eyes to the orderlies helping him, and then back to me. "Charge the tanks," he said, toweling goop off his hands. "I'll take a second to talk to the adjunct here." They nodded and went to work. Their faces were sweaty and grim. To my mind, only two groups of people earned their pay when Varys deployed into the hot zone. The frontline troops and the sorry bastards like this bio who rebuilt us when we fell in combat. For this reason, I was interested in what the bio had to say. "Adjunct James McGill," the bio said, reading his tapper. He frowned for a second. "Aren't you—" "Yeah," I said, cutting him off. "I'm that guy." I didn't know which of my exploits he was thinking of, but it didn't much matter. Whatever crime, exploit, heroic act, or astounding breach of protocol he was pondering, I was almost certainly guilty as charged. He laughed and shook his head. "Okay, then. You deserve the straight story. We're not supposed to say anything that might demoralize the troops, you understand?" "I surely do. You mind if I take that shower after all, real quick-like, while you're talking?" He blinked, but waved me toward the stall. There wasn't anything like privacy in a revival chamber. We were all born naked and slimy. Everything about us was right there in plain sight. In accordance with these realities, the shower was nothing more than a tube-shaped vessel made of clear plastic. I got inside, slammed the door, and poured water onto myself. It felt good, and I thought it was the right move. I was thinking more sharply immediately. "The fighting on the complex is all internal now," the bio told me. "We've been pushed back to inner strongholds. Some units are completely cut off." Long before I'd had my fill, I turned off the water, toweled off, and put on a uniform. It stuck to me in places, but not as badly as it would have if I'd been coated in afterbirth. "How much of the station do the Volbites control?" I asked him. He shrugged. "I get different reports. 20%, 30, something like that. I do know they command everything around the umbilical. They made a big push there." My face twisted into a half-smile. I wondered how much trouble my unit had given them. I hoped the Volbites had suffered a great deal of pain. "So, we're losing?" "Seems like it. We're definitely in retreat." I looked up, and I saw the defeat in his eyes. He knew. Probably everyone did. "What about reinforcements?" His eyes lit up. "More ships are coming? More legions?" Shaking my head, I had to burst his bubble. "No, not that I know of. Not yet." "There won't be a later. We won't last 3 days. "Well, sir," I told him, "you're in luck." "How's that?" "I'm here to fix things." He snorted, clearly not believing me. Still, he did seem curious. He waggled a finger at me.
Now I remember. You were the guy who was permed and brought back. Some people said you attacked a Magua. Is that really true?
No, sir, I said loudly. That's a vicious lie. Do you really think that if I'd done something so heinous, so insane, I'd be standing here talking to you right now?
The bio relaxed and shook his head.
No, I guess not.
Most rumors are like that, I advised him. They fall apart the moment you think about them in the cold light of day.
All right, the bio said, clapping me on the shoulder. Go kill a billion Vulbites for me.
A billion, huh? I asked, trying to sound nonchalant.
Yeah, the population of the planet is supposed to be in that zone, or maybe more.
Sickened, I gave him a big smile. I marched out waving and whistling a little tune. It wasn't until I got to the elevators that I let my real thoughts show.
Billions?
If that was true, we were well and truly screwed over. Nothing I could do in the short term was going to save the situation. All the same, I had to try.
The floor lit up under my feet in the passages, directing me with arrows to the barracks. I ignored them and went off in the opposite direction. Hopefully, no one would notice. A few minutes later, I reached the way station where troops were filing down from the revival chambers to the front lines in the space factory. A centurion stopped me, putting his hand against my chest. He frowned up at me, and I frowned down at him. Recognition lit up my brain. Centurion Manfred, I said, greeting him with a hearty hello. He clapped my arm, but he didn't stop frowning at me.
I said. Is there a problem, sir?
You don't have to sir me, McGill, remember?
Oh, right, what's up?
He pointed at my head.
Your hair is still wet. You can't go right back to the line, man. You should head to the officer's mess and take an hour.
I thought things were bad down there, I said.
They are, but that's all the more reason we need our officers clear-eyed and fully operating in the brain pan.
As he said this, he tapped his temple with a gloved finger. I said, looking around the chamber. There was lots of foot traffic, and to be honest, I'd kind of hoped no one would notice me as I slipped through the way station. One of these two active jump gates led to Earth. It was easy to see which one it was, as heavy troops marched out of it periodically in squads of nine. The other gate was getting far more traffic. Everyone who died and been sent back to the front, plus all the Blood Worlders, were marching through at a pretty steady rate. I wouldn't call it a Congo line, but it was clear we were taking heavy losses and replacing them as fast as we could. None of these people, however, looked like they'd marched here straight from Blue Deck. I was trying to figure out what to say to Manfred, who was really cramping my style. But before I came up with anything good, my tapper began to buzz. I ignored the message, although it was marked urgent and blinked red. I pulled my sleeve over it while it continued to buzz.
"Is that Promise Graves calling?" Manfred asked.
"Nope," I lied.
"But that tone," he said, frowning at me.
"That's a superior officer."
"Right," I said. "Sometimes, well, ladies get concerned at moments like this." Manfred looked baffled for a second, but then he caught on and gave a shout of laughter. Everyone glanced at us, and I forced a grin. Manfred took a step closer to me, and he lowered his voice.
"So it's true," he said, "what they say about you and Turov, that you're meeting her every night?"
"I can neither confirm nor deny that accusation." Shaking his head, he threw his arms wide.
"How can I possibly give a man like you advice? Do what you're gonna do, McGill. See you in hell."
"Thank you, Centurion, and I'm looking forward to it." At last, he stopped pestering me and led a squad of fresh troops through the jump gate that led back to the space factory. I felt a pang to see him go. He was a brave man, and he didn't deserve to die again today unnecessarily. That moment made up my mind for me. I turned away from the jump gate that led back down to the space complex, and I approached the second one.
Hey! A hand shot out and grabbed my bicep. I fought down an urge to put the man on his ass. He was only doing his job. Veteran, I said, nodding to him. Then I did a double take. I knew the guy. It was Veteran Alders, the very man who tried to stop me from entering Galena's quarters the day before. Smiling in recognition, I greeted him like he was a long-lost brother. Hey, Alders, you okay? I'm surprised you can talk with that fat lip. His face fell into a deep scowl. McGill, he said, there's no way you're going AWOL back to Earth. You can just get that idea right out of your head. Two other men, thick arms crossed, came up to support him. They had their shock rods out, but they hadn't flipped them on. That was good because I might have taken things the wrong way if they had. I kept a smile on my face. I'm good at that. Ask any of the women who've arranged a surprise party for me on a night I wanted to watch a ball game. I can smile all the way to the gallows and back again if I have to. Oh, I said. My bad. I'll have you talk to the Tribune then. So saying, I made a show of drawing back my sleeve to reveal my tapper. Red symbols blinked there in the special tone that sounded when officers called their subordinates. Alders said. You don't have to do that. Sure I do, I said. It's no trouble at all. She likes to talk to hogs. I mean veterans, like you guys, who are checking up on her special orders. Alders showed me his teeth, but he looked worried all the same. The other two vets at his side were frowning now, stepping side to side like worried horses. Just get the hell out of here, Alders said at last. It was because of you I drew this shitty post in the first place. Oh, no, I'm really sorry about that. You want me to put in a good word? No, just disappear. Forget I talked to you at all. You drive a hard bargain, Alders, but I accept. Then, before they could change their minds or notice it was actually Graves and Winsley trying to contact me, I stepped in between the gateway posts and vanished. Chapter 28. The jump gate trip was a long one, long enough so I could feel the alien machine breaking me down and assembling me again. Nostrum and Legion Varus were deployed way, way out there. It didn't hurt, not exactly. It was more like a fluttering sensation that rippled through my guts. When I was whole again, I stood in a northern field. The land was green with a thick carpet of grass, and the soil was black and wet beneath it. I almost doubled over with that freaky sensation in my guts fluttering and bubbling, and events didn't give me time to recover. A squadron of heavy troopers was marching right toward me, single file. Not being too bright, and being the type that followed orders to the letter, they marched right into my face without breaking stride. I dove to the left, rolling off the platform and onto the grass. Getting up and brushing myself off, I looked up at Earth's bright yellow sun. Even up north, here in Nova Scotia, our star was brighter than the one I'd left behind. Despite the unpleasant welcome, I felt glad to be back. Right off, I knew I liked Earth best. The Magua might call my planet a backward dirt hole, lacking in refinement in every possible way. But she would always be home to me. While I was brushing myself off and adjusting my kit, I sensed the approach of another squad of large beings. Looking around, I saw a trio of lanky slavers approaching. They had that dumb but mean stare on their faces. The slavers surrounded me on that grassy hill. They could talk, but they usually didn't bother. Today was no exception to that rule. They stared at me like a bug on a dinner plate, a bug they didn't like, but which they didn't quite have the guts to squish. Gentlemen, I said, looking up at the slavers, I'm Adjunct James McGill, a human officer in Legion Varus. I'm here to talk to your commander.
Without a word, they formed up a triangle around me. I felt like a little kid being surrounded by football players. With hardly any daylight between them, they began to march. I marched with them. It was that or be walked over and trampled. Blood Worlders didn't talk much as a group. The really big ones, the giants, lacked the capacity to speak more than a few dozen words. They were more into taking orders than giving them. Once these guys had been given a task, they followed it unswervingly until they died or succeeded. They were born and bred to be that way. The slavers didn't lay hands on me, and I was glad for that. Sometimes I got angry when I was handled improperly and bad things happened. Luckily for all of us, they merely used this herding technique of theirs to walk me to a command post. The tent flaps were drawn wide. The tent itself was impressive, looking more like something that belonged in a circus than the great outdoors. The front man of the slaver trio stepped aside, allowing me to walk inside. I did so, thanking them for serving as guides. Their faces registered nothing, not even confusion, just a blank. "You boys are fresh from Blood World, aren't you?" I asked, laughing. "I can tell you just got here." Inside the tent, another large figure sat at a folding desk. This being was just as big as the heavy troopers, but he had a very different configuration of limbs. "A cephalopod?" I asked in surprise.
"I am Subcenturion Bubble,"
he said in a deadly serious tone. My mouth twitched, but I sensed it wasn't the time to bust out laughing, so I contained myself. Cephalopods were usually named after some property of water, and this squid was no exception to that rule. "A subcenturion, huh?" I asked. "Tell me, as a human adjunct, am I expected to salute you?" The squid looked startled at this suggestion. His numerous eyes widened in unison.
"Certainly not. That would be improper. I'm a subcenturion, meaning a leader among slaves."
"Right," I said. "Good, then. Here's what I need you to do for me, Bubbles."
"It's Bubble," he interrupted. "The singular form."
"Yeah, well, forgive me if I get it wrong." Bubble ruffled himself.
"There's no need for a human to ask forgiveness from a slave commander," he said in a formal tone. "However, although I serve humans, it's not you in particular I serve. I'm concerned that you're not a legitimate authority here, as you're not assigned to this post."
"Ah, so you're a stickler, huh?" I asked. "Tell me, Squid, have you heard of Praetor Drusus?"
"Of course. He governs the defense of Earth."
"That's him. Now, he's the man I need to talk to. He's the man I answer to directly when everything is said and done." The squid looked confused and wary.
"Is this an attempt to get me to damage myself?"
"What?"
"My reputation. If I forward your request, I may be in error. That will lower my status, possibly making me lose my subcenturion rank."
"On the other hand," I said, "if I am an acting agent working for Drusus and you delay my urgent message from the front lines, you'll be in big trouble. They'll boil you in your own ink back at Central." The squid looked alarmed all over again. I knew a thing or two about squids, having dealt with them for years. They really had boiled each other in ink back in the old days when they were running their own empire.
"There's no reason to resort to threats,"
Bubble said. "No? Good. Now contact Drusus for me." The squid hesitated further. His tentacles squirmed around indecisively.
"Why can't you use your tapper to place this call?"
"I'm a secret agent. I need help. There are enemies of the state after me, and I require your assistance. Are you refusing to render aid?"
"No," he said.
and he began working his tapper at last. The real reason I didn't use my tapper was a practical one. Hegemony tracked all humans via their tappers. According to the Central's data core, I'd been assigned to a post on Darkworld. Accessing the net and placing calls would set off alarm bells, and very possibly it would result in my arrest by less-than-friendly folks. The squid indicated the surface of his desk. I walked forward and used one finger to spin around the image so it faced me. "Hey there," I said, liking what I saw. A young adjunct with short-cropped hair was playing the part of receptionist for Drusus. I was impressed, as this alone told me he was true brass. Most officers only had AI faces answering their calls. Besides, she was kind of pretty.
"Who are you, adjunct?" she asked. "What happened to the sub-centurion?"
"Bubbles is right here, don't worry," I told her. "I'm Adjunct James McGill from Legion Varus. I need to talk to the Praetor. It's urgent." Her face had been open and inquisitive, but it quickly closed down into an unpleasant scowl. I thought to myself she should avoid that type of expression. It would undoubtedly draw premature wrinkles on her face, and that would be a shame.
"Legion Varus has been deployed," she said. "All information concerning that legion is classified. This call is at an end, adjunct."
"Wait," I said. "Hold on, girl. Think for a second. I'm a member of that legion. I'm on Earth. Something has gone wrong with the Varus mission. Something has gone very wrong, and I've been sent to tell Drusus about it." She hesitated. I could tell she wanted to cut me off, but she wasn't quite sure that she should. Before she spoke again, I pressed my advantage. "Classified missions sometimes use unconventional channels when communicating their status back to the brass," I said. "Now all you have to do is contact Drusus and tell him who's calling. If he doesn't want to talk, well then, I'm in error." That pretty face was scowling right up until the moment she hooked me up to Drusus, but I no longer cared. There were bigger things to worry about now. Drusus's face appeared. "McGill? Really? Yes, sir, it's your lucky day." He heaved a sigh. "Then why is it that my lunch is already churning in my stomach?" "Well, sir, my family has a number of remedies for that sort of thing. I'll have to tell you about them sometime."
"I look forward to it," he said dryly. "Now why are you on Earth and why are you calling me?"
Right then, I knew I had him. He was in the palm of my hand. It almost wriggled free, what with the aliens and his secretary, but I'd gotten through. I think the reason Drusus put up with so much bullshit from me was because I intrigued him. We were polar opposites. He was a man of calm judgment, decorum, and strict adherence to the rule book. And I, on the other hand, I was a scoundrel. A man without any respect for the rules other than common decency in all its forms. Requesting a private talk before I spilled my guts, I learned Drusus had already dispatched an air car. It was coming from his office, and it arrived quickly. I was surprised to see there was no driver. I climbed in, and the air car lifted off. I was whisked away to Central. We had plenty of auto-piloting vehicles these days, of course, but they weren't that common in air cars, especially ones heading to Central. Lawyers and bureaucrats, that's who'd stopped Earth's development in AI. They'd started right in during the 21st century, suing the pants off every auto-driven car manufacturer. Later on, when our AI got smarter, the Galactics had rolled in the NARBs and pretty much outlawed the use of such systems. While I rode the skies to Central, I pondered the Empire. The core bedrock of the biggest organization in history, the glue that had kept it together for thousands of years, was economic in nature. By maintaining strict regional trading rights on many products, including AI systems, the Galactics had both kept the lesser races from improving and made us dependent on each other at the same time. Since AI systems were a trade good from the Pegasus star system, it was illegal for us to make them very smart here on Earth. If you want a true, smart air car,
You had to pay up to the pegs, as they were known. Since the pegs liked to charge too many galactic credits per license, we relied mostly on dumb, cheap robots. During the flight, I had time to wonder what this flying AI-driven car might indicate. Were we flaunting age-old laws? Or had we paid off the pegs? Or possibly we'd become so important to the galactics that we were now allowed to bend certain rules? Whatever the correct answer was, I thought it would be an interesting question to ask Drusus when I saw him. When I landed at Central, things didn't quite go the way I'd expected. In fact, I didn't exactly land at all. As the car was descending, the roof opened up and swallowed it whole. Sinking down a deep shaft, I looked up, craning my neck to peer out the passenger window. Above me, a blue square of sky could be seen. Rapidly, this square became a rectangle, then a slit, and finally winked out entirely. I said, wondering what was going on. Hey, car! AI! Who's driving this thing? Can you talk? There was no response, and that got me to frowning. In case something had gone terribly wrong, I felt an urge to take action. I'm not a sit-still-and-take-it-quietly kind of guy under most circumstances. So I began to climb from the back seat into the front. Maybe with a real human at the wheel, the car would pay more attention to me. The first thing I discovered was my seat belt didn't release. I thumbed it, whacked it, and gave it a mighty tug. Nothing. A moment later, I slashed myself free. A big rip appeared in the tank-grown leather seat, but I figured that was just too damned bad. The owner should have instructed the car to talk. Wriggling over the seats from the back end to the front, I seized the wheel. The air car bucked a little, and a spark, no, make that a whole long streak of sparks, began flaring up from the fender on the passenger side. Damn it, I said, trying to angle away from the wall. I overcorrected, as apparently the shaft the car was descending into was a very tight squeeze. I winced as a screeching sound began again. It set my teeth on edge like fingernails on a rough surface. Getting desperate, I considered kicking out the windshield next, but I didn't do it. Taking about 6 deep breaths, I reasoned things through. If Drusus had wanted me dead, he didn't have to go to all this trouble. He'd have just ordered the Blood Worlders to shoot me when I was still back up in Nova Scotia. Bubbles would have done it, too. Squids were natural bastards on their best day. So, logically, I wasn't in any danger. And even if I was, there wasn't much I could do about it. I couldn't fly the car back up the shaft. The door at the top had closed, and the shaft was so narrow I'd probably wreck the car in the attempt. Sighing, I relaxed, took my hands off the steering wheel, and sat back. My arms were crossed, and I rode in brooding silence down about 100 floors. At last, light expanded and brightened under the car. It came down for a very gentle landing.
Chapter 29. When the air car landed, I took a good look around. I found myself in a luxurious office, a real surprise for Central. First off, the room was big. Possibly this entire floor of Central had been used to make this one gigantic chamber. Distantly, I saw a figure rise from a desk and approach the car. As if the car itself recognized the man, it rolled down a window for me. "Ah, McGill," Praetor Drusus called out. "There you are." It was time for a grin of greeting, so I created one, despite the fact it didn't come from my heart. "Praetor Drusus," I called out, bellowing back at him. I opened the car door gently, not wanting to do any further damage, and climbed out. "What do you think of my new car from Pegasus? Sweet Jesus!" Drusus broke off. Dumbfounded, he walked around the vehicle and surveyed the damage. There was a wisp of smoke and a powerful odor. My best guess was one of the tires had been abraded down to nothing, like a pencil eraser in the hands of a grade schooler. Standing beside the vehicle, my smile faded away. I said, I think the AI might need some adjustment.
I don't believe this, Drusus said, making a second circuit of the car, faster this time.
He spotted and touched each damaged component. Shaking my head, I made a tisking sound. A damn shame, surprising too, seeing as it's a genuine Pegasus product. Those aliens really know what they're doing, usually.
Drusus looked like I'd run over his cat. This car was trained to come down that shaft to my new office on its very first day, and it's never made a navigational error before.
Calibration, I said firmly. That's what it needs. These vehicles can be tricky, sir. Just ask Turov. She's had several air cars.
Drusus finally looked up at me, peering into my eyes. His expression had shifted from open and welcoming to suspicious. For my own part, I thought his mind was traveling down unfair pathways. He was already suspecting me. Sure, I'd wrecked his car, but that wasn't the point. Why couldn't he at least give me the benefit of the doubt? None of my thoughts showed on my face, naturally. In fact, I maintained a dumbfounded frown of shared concern. My hands were on my hips, and I eyed the car curiously, as if trying to fathom the mystery of its status.
Drusus let his eyes travel over the car, then me, and then the shaft overhead.
When you got out of the car, you were in the driver's seat, weren't you?
He asked. Yes, sir. I get sick in back seats. It's been that way since I was a kid.
He nodded slowly. He opened the back door. There, plain to see, the seat belt and seats had been slashed. The foam padding underneath was exposed and mushrooming up in an ugly-looking manner.
Drusus straightened and looked at me with his teeth clamped together.
I shouldn't have done it, he said. It's my fault.
What's your fault, Preta, sir?
I shouldn't have allowed a man of your caliber into my air car. If you don't want something damaged, you don't stick it into a blender.
Words to live by, Preta. We regarded one another seriously for a moment. Finally, Drusus turned his back on his car and walked away. He was making an obvious effort to drop his anger and focus just on me. I found this impressive. It was a clear example of how Drusus wasn't like normal people. He could put aside petty troubles in order to seek important solutions to bigger problems. Since he'd made such a magnanimous move, I decided to do the same.
Let me cut right to it, sir, I said, walking after him.
I'm here because we're about to lose Dark World. Turov needs to call in reinforcements, but she doesn't want to do it.
Drusus frowned. You realize she's assured me, as recently as this morning, that she can hold and soon advance her position.
Maybe, but that's bullshit, sir. I've been on the front lines and I've died there. The Volbites have pushed us back. By now, they probably control half the factory complex.
Volbites aren't that sophisticated, Drusus argued.
It's a simple matter of numbers. They have more.
He stared at me for a moment. Come over to my desk, he said.
I followed him, and he led me to a command table. Normally, units like this were located in the center of a command post, but Drusus had one of his own. A sweep of his hand woke up the table, and a few more gestures brought up a schematic of the space complex.
This is the latest sitrep from Varus Command, he said. You're telling me it's in error?
Frowning, I pored over the map. It took a minute to get my bearings. The place was big and complicated, and some of its regions had yet to be explored.
There, I said, spotting the holdout position my unit had defended until my last death.
That was where I was stationed yesterday, but it's gone now, in enemy hands.
The region I'd indicated was tinted blue, which meant it was supposedly firmly held border territory. The outer hull was red, meaning it was in enemy hands, but there were spots of blue out there too. The deeper levels were all green, meaning safe.
What else? He asked.
That whole level and two more below it? That's all gone, sir.
And these spots of interaction on the outer hull, contested, that's a joke. We abandoned those yesterday. Keep in mind that I'm not even sure how much worse it is right now. Drusus leaned on the table, putting both his palms on it. The table made flashing ripples around his hands, trying to figure out what he wanted to do next.
I don't understand how she could do it. Or why.
We were talking about Turov. I understood, and I felt a pang. I was in the very act of ratting her out. My relationship with Galina had never been anything like normal. We'd killed each other, loved each other, and backstabbed one another many times. But today, I was taking action because I felt I had to. She was only one of the friends I had out there on Dark World. The others were fighting and dying in a hopeless battle because of her. And it wasn't like I was doing this to get revenge on her. I was motivated to save my friends the agony of frequent death and the possible loss of this valuable asset for the home world. Earth needed a frontline industrial base, just as Drusus had explained. I'm not sure how this map was faked or who did it, I said. But I think, yes, looking at this layout, I'd say you have old data. They're feeding you maps from the early hours, right after the invasion and the original counterattacks. Things have changed for the worse lately. He nodded, looking morose.
I shouldn't have sent Turov, he said. It's my fault, in a way. I demoted her, humiliated her, and at the same time removed a more capable officer from the Legion.
I wouldn't take all the blame myself if I were you, sir. He looked at me. If the soldier disobeys, it's the soldier's fault. But if the order was incorrect, or the general was unclear, it's the general's fault. Do you know who said that?
No.
Sun Tzu. I'm paraphrasing, but the logic fits. I placed the wrong commander on the scene after having put her in a no-win position. How'd you do that, sir?
Turov is very ambitious. I'm sure you've noticed.
I laughed. I might have at that.
Well, when you demote someone, they're naturally out to prove themselves and regain their rank. That instinct is doubly strong in Galina Turov.
Oh, I said. I think I understand what you're saying. She's taking risks, delaying the reports of bad news, hoping against hope she can pull this off and come out a hero.
Exactly, Drusa said. And all because I made a series of errors in judgment.
There was an awkward moment of silence. I still didn't quite get why Drusus was blaming himself rather than Turov.
Sir, I asked, why exactly did you move Deitch up into the top brass?
His head rose, but he didn't meet my eyes.
That was a mistake, too, I'm afraid. She's a good officer, don't get me wrong, but my motivations weren't appropriate.
That word, appropriate, that set off alarm bells.
Sir, I asked, you and Deitch aren't,
maybe I shouldn't ask any more.
No, you shouldn't, he said.
Sucking in a deep breath, Drusus straightened his spine again. He'd been half slumped over the command table all this time, not meeting my eyes. Now he turned around and faced me again.
I'm sending you back, he said.
Okay. With a new legion right behind you.
I brightened. Which one, sir?
The Iron Eagles.
Oh, I said in disappointment.
You don't approve? He asked.
That's not my place to just give me your opinion as a man on the spot.
Well, so the Iron Eagles is a fine outfit, one of Earth's best. But they're kind of straight-laced, if you know what I mean. I'm not sure they'll mesh well with Varys.
He smiled grimly. That's what I'm counting on.
Deitch used to command the Eagles, did you know that?
Yes, sir.
That was another, more private reason why I was worried about the choice. Deitch seemed to be behind Galena's fall, and she might be pressing for Drusus to use her old legion to bail out Varys in the field.
I said.
Who might be placed in charge of the whole op, sir?
Imperator Deitch, of course, he said.
She has the appropriate rank to run a two-legion operation. Besides, she's recently commanded both of these outfits. I can't think of anyone more qualified. My lips curled up to bare my teeth, and I wanted to make a hissing sound, but I didn't.